Centre for Cities was delighted to host a roundtable with Carl Weisbrod, Chairman of the New York City Planning Commission. In a career spanning more than 40 years, Carl's successes include transforming Times Square into the commercial hub we see today, as well as regenerating Hudson Park and leading the post 9/11 recovery of downtown Manhattan. He has also had a significant role in addressing the problems caused by New York City's unaffordable housing market. Over to you, Carl.
Thank you. So this is going to be rather free-form. So now I'm going to talk, I guess, a little bit of a sweep of history in New York over the last 40 years, but really with a focus on what's going on in New York today and what the challenges are that we face, and I suspect not dissimilar to the challenges that you face, and probably before I even start, the place to start really is the basic problem that cities, I think successful cities, are now facing that we never thought we would face 25 years ago, certainly when we were addressing the similarities and differences between London and New York, and that is the issue of terrorism, and certainly for me, getting off the underground and going to London Bridge, and of course seeing what happened in Manchester a few weeks ago just raised for me a memory of what we suffered in New York as well, and it's the challenge, one of the challenges of our time. So my sympathies to all of you, but also recognizing and seeing that the life and success of cities just go on. And this is just a new dynamic, sadly, that we all face. Well, we didn't face this. I started in New York City government some 40 years ago working for then Mayor John Lindsay at a time when trajectory of cities in the United States was really on the downward path, and when New York City was losing population, where crime was rampant, where every social revolution you could imagine was thriving and well underway, good and bad, from civil rights revolution to the feminist revolution to the sexual revolution, to the onslaught of crime and drugs on the other hand, and the fate of cities was not really very with an expectation of cities, particularly in New York, was not great at that time. And in fact, the watchword among some planners in New York was planned shrinkage, and how the city should consider withdrawing to its core and abandoning parts of the city that seemed indefensible at the time, where there was a significant amount of middle-class flight, where whole neighborhoods were unoccupied, where buildings were vacant and eroding. And fortunately for New York, shrinkage was not adopted as a strategy, and starting roughly in the late 1970s, partly as a product of the New York City fiscal crisis when New York City basically went bankrupt, New York City turned around. And I think to some extent that turnaround was due to a series of strong mayors. New York has a very strong mayor system, and both managerial mayors and ideological mayors, and mayors whose ideology are on basically opposite ends of the spectrum. But I think also, and certainly due in some significant measure to tremendous transformation in policing and police science, which I think at its core has a lot to do with New York City's turnaround, but I think it also has to do with some fundamental trends that are taking place around the world and have been taking place the last 25 years. And you see it in London as much as we see it in New York, and that is, I think, one of the big lessons that we've learned over the last 25 years is that business goes to where the talent is. Talent doesn't go to where the business is. And so the economic development strategy of New York has become one of how do we attract talent to the city and what has to be done to attract that talent. And I should say that for the most part, that should be a relatively easy sell because high-quality talent wants to be in cities for a whole variety of reasons. And second, because I think that partly that's because cities offer the kind of lifestyle that particularly young talent wants, and partly because talent is seen for what it is today by business and less seen for its demographic roots. And New York, like London, has thrived on its diversity and its openness to immigration, and certainly for global businesses, but even for businesses that just really want to attract talent without regard to ethnicity or race or gender or nationality, the most likely place to find that is in our thriving cities. And so I think for New York and for London as well, those factors have really led to a dramatic turnaround in how the city is perceived, and certainly since the late 1970s, New York City has been growing to the point that now its population is at an all-time high. I think just about the same size as London, maybe slightly smaller in terms of population. We're currently at 8.55 million people, and anticipating growing to 9 million people by 2040. I know you're expecting to grow faster than that. I'll come back to that in a minute. Second, our jobs are at an all-time high. We have 4.3 million jobs now in the city of New York. That's an all-time record. And our crime is at an all-time low. That's not historically been so much of an issue for London, but for New York, that's been a very, very important metric, and obviously essential for us in terms of keeping and retaining talent in the city. So this has been a sort of a virtuous cycle for the city, and has been, New York City, and has been for some 20 plus years now, despite the bumps along the way, of which 9/11 was certainly one, which the recession in 2007, 2008 was another. But the trend has been very, very positive over the last 20 plus years. And this has created many opportunities. Generally speaking, it's been a very good thing, but it's also created a lot of issues for the city, and perhaps foremost among them is the growing understanding that we are becoming more and more a city of inequality, a city that is particularly appealing to the very rich, has a seemingly intractable percentage of our population that is very poor, that is below the poverty line. Roughly 20% of our population is below the poverty line. An additional 20% is near poverty. And that percentage of our total population really hasn't changed that much in the last 20 years, despite a lot of effort to change it. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but In part, I think the city has focused more on how, which is not something that I think was necessarily a mistake, but focused more on how to attract and retain the talent it needs than the issues surrounding equity. I was here and I think gave a talk at New London Architects just after Bill de Blasio was elected mayor. And that was in 2014. And he asked me to co-chair his transition from, I'm always stunned by London, which has zero transition. You get elected the next day, all of a sudden you're the mayor. It's just frightening, or the prime minister, or whatever. I just can't imagine how that happens and how you can possibly be prepared for it. But in New York, there's quite a not as long as a stretch as there is in Washington, D.C., but there is a pretty long stretch between the time you're elected, which is in early November, and the time you actually take office as mayor, which is January 1st. So there's a six-week transition period, and mayors traditionally put together an elaborate transition process. What made Bill de Blasio's transition process a little different, and I should step back a second and say, I think one of the reasons, if not the reason, I said this when I was here shortly after the election, that Bill de Blasio got elected among a field of some six or seven candidates, many of whom were much better known than he was and had occupied more significant offices, is that he was the only candidate who was running for mayor at that time who had a very clear message. He was the only one who could get out there and say, this is what I stand for. And the messages of all the others were extremely muddled. And if I can say, probably shouldn't say something about your recent election here and the election in the United States. And I think part of the problem for Hillary Clinton, who I know and I suspect here as well, is that the message of the message was not very clear. It was not incisive in any way. And for Hillary, it was largely a message of I'm not Donald Trump and he's terrible. And while that's in my view true, nevertheless, I think there's a real need to have a clear message, and Bill de Blasio, when he ran for mayor in 2013, to take office at the beginning of 2014, did have that message. That message in 2013 was largely around crime enforcement, an issue of stop and frisk, because police were, in their efforts to reduce and control crime, were stopping people on the streets with a particularly minority people, minority kids on the street. And that, I think, resonated with a big portion of the population, and the just general theme of equity resonated with a big portion of the population. But once he was elected, the George Soros Open Society Foundation, actually collaborating with HRNA, my current firm, my former firm before I went back into city government, and my colleague here, Catherine, did something a little different for transitions in New York. We organized a sort of a transition tent in a very visible location. And anyone in the city could come in for a 4 or 5 week period and tell the mayor-elect and his team what it was that they were hoping he would do. And there were panel discussions, there was television, there was the local television station broadcast from this very visible tent that went on for several weeks and about and went on for about, I guess, about 15 hours a day. It was really unique and very active and extremely hard work, and I don't think anyone's ever going to do it again, but it was highly informative. In collaboration with the activities at the tent, this effort went out to every neighborhood in the city through mobile vans and elicited the input of just citizens in every single community in New York, many of whom would never go to a tent or would never leave their own neighborhood. And while the data from that output or that outreaching was not technically a random survey and so consequently not statistically valid, it was probably the largest endeavor ever to elicit the views of New Yorkers. I think something like 80,000 people provided their comments. And interestingly, the what we found out was that the issue that was most important to New Yorkers was not crime, was not equity even in the broadest sense, or in the narrow sense, it was housing. And that was true in every single neighborhood in New York, whether it was a rich neighborhood, a poor neighborhood, a middle-class neighborhood. Housing was the number one concern, and the affordability of housing. Not so much the habitability of housing, but the affordability of housing and concerns about rising rents. And so what had hardly been discussed during the campaign for mayor became an overarching issue and the number one thing that the mayor decided to address when he took office. And we started really on that right away and found out a number of really startling facts. One, our population was growing and was at an all-time high. Two, the gap between the number of households in the city that were poor or extremely poor and the amount of housing units that that population could afford, judging by the sort of universal standard, I suppose, of households should spend no more than 30% of its income on rent, was 500,000 units. We were 500,000 units short on day one. Three, that we were not building housing, even market rate housing, sufficient to house the growing population in New York, to say nothing of not building enough affordable housing. And the Bloomberg administration, an administration that was in many ways a highly competent administration, had in fact produced over 12 years some 165,000 units of affordable housing, either through new units or preserved units. But despite the fact that they had actually produced 165,000 units, the city had actually lost ground because more than 165,000 units had actually dropped out of affordability. So New York City was actually falling further and further and further behind. So this, and the mayor had been left with a homeless problem, a challenge that of some 49,000 people who were, at the time he took office, in homeless shelters. That number has actually grown over the last 3 years to more than 60,000 people today. New York City is the only city in the United States, perhaps the only city in the world, at least the only one that I'm aware of, that is under a legal mandate to house every single night every single individual. We can't, except in extreme weather conditions, force somebody to go into a shelter, but every single person, if they just arrive at the city shores the night before and say, I have no place to stay, New York City is under law required to house them, at least give them shelter. So in addition to the yawning gap between what people could afford and what the number of units that were available to them, there were and are 60,000 people now, 25,000 of them children, housed in homeless shelters, which is just a lot and unacceptable for a civilized society. And then, on top of that, there are an untold number of thousands of people and households that are living in overcrowded conditions, which, if housing was available to them, would certainly, at least some members of that extended household would leave. We don't even know how many people fit into that category. So solving the housing crisis, or at least addressing the housing crisis, became the number one task of the city. And to the mayor's credit, he launched by far the most aggressive housing program of any municipality in the United States. In fact, it is a housing program that is greater than the next 50 cities in the United States combined. So it's just a massive scale and can be undertaken by a city in the United States. And essentially it consists of, if I remember this correctly, five or six different components. The first, of course, is money. The city has allocated $8 billion out of its own capital resources. As the city has a 10-year capital plan, and it's roughly an $80 billion 10-year capital plan. So about 10% of all the capital resources in the city over a 10-year period from 2014 to 2024 is allocated to subsidizing housing. Two, the city has enacted a very aggressive mandatory inclusionary zoning provision that requires every single time the city upzones a neighborhood, and I don't think you technically have zoning here, but New York City is rigorously, some would say, in an overly complex way, overly regulated way, land use is governed by zoning that determines how much can be built, what can be built on any particular piece of property in the city. We're an as-of-right city, which means that if you comply with the zoning regulations of the city of New York, you do not have to have your development plans reviewed by any sort of discretionary body. You just apply for a building permit. You say you comply, you show that you comply with zoning, and you get a building permit, and you can build. That's unlike most cities. I'm certainly unlike London in most respects, but it does create a scheme that limits how much you can build. So anytime the city of New York now expands the zoning capacity of a neighborhood, anyone who builds in that neighborhood, residential capacity of a neighborhood, anyone in that neighborhood that builds, any developer, is required to provide either 25 or 30% of the total floor area development rights in that neighborhood that they're building, or in that project, or in that building, whatever they're building, to affordable housing. Essentially, the developer has to allocate 25% of the available floor area if the affordability is deeper, and 30% if it's shallower in terms of affordability. and that housing is permanently affordable. And with very, very few exceptions, that housing must be on site in that building, in that development. It can't be, can't say, well, I'll build my affordable requirement 5 miles away in the South Bronx. You've got to do it on site because the underpinnings of it are based on achieving a degree of economic diversity. It's not going to produce as many affordable units as simply massive subsidies, but it will increase economic diversity and will provide a cross subsidy from market rate housing. The third thing that the city did was change its zoning requirements to eliminate parking requirements for affordable housing in what we call transit-rich areas, that is, areas close to mass transit or immediately near mass transit. Parking has, I think, the three-third rails of land use in New York City are parking density and height. And needless to say, parking produced a huge outcry of resistance, but the city went ahead and got its city council to eliminate parking requirements for affordable housing, thereby reducing the costs of building affordable housing. It also loosened the zoning envelope, so for developers who built affordable housing, thereby making it easier to build affordable housing and also reducing the cost of affordable housing. The fourth thing that the city did was agree to look at 15 neighborhoods throughout New York City and do a comprehensive plan for those neighborhoods. One element of it would be a vast increase in development capacity in order to achieve greater density, more affordability in those neighborhoods. Each one of those, I probably don't have to tell anyone in this room, is a controversy in and of itself, a real challenge, because neighborhoods resist change for lots of reasons, for cultural reasons, for economic reasons, for just fear of change, for fear because increased density means creates a fear that public services and public investment will not accompany that increased density. So what the city did was say, for the first time really, we're going to look at these neighborhoods in a comprehensive way. We're not just going to increase density, we're also going to look at and invest in all of the accompanying public investments that are required when we do increase density. Schools, open space, better transit, better streetscape, better lighting, and the like. And created a separate fund only deployable in those neighborhoods that the city was undertaking these comprehensive plans in, a $1 billion fund strictly to pay for those public investments in those neighborhoods in order to address the fears that public investments would not accompany increased density. The first of those plans was adopted in East New York and Brooklyn in 2016, last year. Several others are wending their way through the public approval process now. Each of them is fraught with community tensions, political difficulties, challenges, and the like, but at the end of the day, I think all will ultimately be approved, and some political risk to the mayor, who's been, I think, extremely brave on this issue. And as a result of that, we're now 2 years into this 10-year plan, and the goal has been to establish 80,000 units of new development over 10 years, 120,000 units of preserved housing. And in order to avoid the the pitfalls that the Bloomberg administration experienced of whatever you pour into the top of the bucket, making sure that units don't fall out of the bottom of the bucket, that all 200,000 of these units, both the preserved units and the new units, are permanently affordable. That is, they're not just affordable for a period of time, but they're affordable forever. Another reason, by the way, that it's so important for New York City that the affordable units be integrated into the market rate housing developments, because developers, owners, are not going to walk away from their market rate units, whereas if they were allowed to put their affordable units someplace else, who knows what would happen 10 years down the line. 2 years into this, the city is ahead of schedule, and I'm reasonably optimistic if the economy holds up that 200,000 units will be preserved and developed. That said, this is not going to solve New York City's housing crisis. And I should say there's also a goal of building 160,000 market rate units over that 10-year period. That's not going to solve the city's housing crisis. But it's going to make a dent in it. And I think one lesson that New York City has taken, or at least I've taken from this experience, and certainly a sea change from the last, the way the city thought about the world 30 or 40 years ago, is that the city does not exist in a bubble, and it is essential that the city work cooperatively with its region. Historically, New York City and the rest of the metropolitan region have been at war with each other, and the city has tended to view the region, regional dynamic as a zero-sum game, that if New York City lost a middle-class family to one of the surrounding suburbs, that was a loss, or if a company left New York City and moved to Long Island or Westchester or New Jersey, that was a loss. That's not the way the city thinks about this anymore and can't think about it, really, because, for among other reasons, New York City, for all that New York City has done well, the suburbs around New York City have not done so well. And this is not so different, I think, than the experience that you're seeing here in the UK, where London is doing very well, and the north, at least, and maybe the south as well, is not quite keeping up to the same pace. So now, instead of a dynamic where we are think of the region as a zero-sum game, and we're at war with the rest of the region, we really have to think about how we help the rest of the region function better, how the rest of the region is actually holding New York City back right now. It's not competitive. It's actually restrictive. Then there are other storm clouds on the horizon, and I will just mention a few of them and probably stop there and we can have a discussion. Among them certainly is, we don't know what's going to, I don't think any of us know what's going to come from the Trump administration. Every day is a surprise. the budget, the federal budget does not hold good news for New York City, and as the city's, if that budget should be enacted, there will be a significant loss in funding for the city, which the city will have to make up, and whether that will have to come out of housing funds remains unclear. The issue of immigration, which is an issue you face as well here, and the source of so much of New York City's strength, which is that more than a third of New Yorkers were born outside the United States. If that stream of talent is cut off, that will not be good news for New York City. Third, the growth curve is flattening. We're still growing, but the growth rate is slowed and may flatten more. So I think we'll hit 9 million people, but growth beyond that is by no means certain. And fourth, we have a serious infrastructure challenge. Our infrastructure, we are the densest urban infrastructure in the United States, but it is deteriorated. It is not up to remotely up to standard. We look at the work the TFL is doing with envy. Our Metropolitan Transportation Authority is does not have not only the vision that TFL has here, but doesn't even have the vision that other cities in the United States have, for example, Metro Los Angeles. And that's a real challenge to us. The future, the present is reasonably bright for New York. The future hopefully will remain bright, but there are certainly storm clouds brewing. And with that, I will stop and be delighted to answer questions.